I think the ruling that the judge had was awesome.
A judge rules the controversial Stand for Salmon initiative can move forward. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, October 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also today, tonight, Alaskans celebrate the first official Indigenous Peoples Day.
Today, a lot of people are wearing their atikluks, their kusbuks, their regalia, their native bling earrings and barrettes. Every year, it's only going to grow from here on out.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact this station to learn more.
A controversial ballot initiative intended to protect salmon habitat has cleared a major hurdle, setting up what could be an intense political fight. A judge in Anchorage today ruled that Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott was wrong to deny the initiative organized by the nonprofit Stand for Salmon. Mallott rejected the ballot measure last month, arguing it would tie the state's hands and prioritize salmon habitat over other potential uses of state land, like mining or oil development. The state says if it's enacted, the measure could complicate efforts to build projects ranging from pipelines to the proposed Pebble Mine. The initiative also drew opposition from a wide range of industry groups. At a hearing last week, the attorney defended the ballot initiative, argued that it wasn't aimed at prohibiting development, though it would add to the permitting process. Judge Mark Ridner agreed. He wrote, it's, quote, pure speculation, unquote, to predict the effect of the initiative. Mike Wood, one of the ballot measure's organizers, applauded the decision.
I think the ruling that the judge had was awesome. You know, set politics aside and read it for what it is. And I think he did that.
Wood, a commercial fisherman, was involved in opposition to the Susitna Dam. Marliana Hall is executive director of the Resource Development Council, one of the groups opposed to the ballot initiative. Hall says she's disappointed and her group is asking the state to appeal.
Unfortunately, this initiative, as it is, poses a grave threat to community and resource development. It puts economic activities highly at risk.
Stand for Salmon can now begin collecting signatures. It aims to get the initiative on the ballot in 2018. Lawyers with the state say they're evaluating whether to appeal the decision to the Alaska Supreme Court. Amid growing frustration over an uptick in crime, officials in Anchorage are weighing what kind of solutions they'd like to see from lawmakers in Juneau. The Anchorage Assembly took the rare step of holding a meeting Saturday to hear public testimony on what residents would like to see done about Senate Bill 91, the omnibus criminal justice reform measure signed into law in July of 2016. In the time since, a debate has raged over whether provisions in the bill are worsening the city's levels of property and violent crime. One resident with that view is Cindy Moore, whose daughter was killed by her boyfriend in 2014. Moore is advocating for reform.
Our system was broken before SB 91. Now that SB 91 has passed, it's worse.
The Assembly's Public Safety Committee is currently assessing two resolutions to send to state legislators. The measures are non-binding but could influence how Anchorage's large delegation pursues reforms in the coming special session and beyond. One proposal asks for an increase in funding for alcohol and drug counseling promised under the law, along with modest revisions to the legal code. A competing resolution asks for a full repeal of SB 91, which the sponsor says is too broken to be fixed. next. Nearly everyone who spoke during 4 hours of testimony demanded a full repeal. Richard Evans has lived in Anchorage most of his life. He says he's frustrated by the years-long rise in crime and what he says is an inadequate response from police that leaves citizens and business owners like himself ready to take security into their own hands.
I'm not going to call Anchorage Police Department if someone breaks into my house. I will not call them to stop the crime. I will not call them to deal with the people coming into my house. I will be calling them to pick up a corpse.
When SB 91 passed, its aim was to save taxpayers' money by reducing jail time for nonviolent offenders and put the savings into treatment and anti-recidivism programming. Elected officials in Anchorage say they are not receiving state money for substance abuse treatment. And some prosecutors say scaling back on penalties for misdemeanor crimes like shoplifting and low-level theft has emboldened criminality. Michael Schaefer is a municipal prosecutor and says SB 91 has made the office's work harder.
From a prosecution level, it has dramatically impaired the tools that we have to effectively hold people to account. And that's what we do.
Schaefer says the office is facing pressure from multiple fronts. The state district attorney's office, which handles more serious felony crimes in Anchorage, has less capacity because of legislative cuts to the Department of Law. As a result, Schaefer says the DA's office declines a greater number of serious cases. A small number of those who testified on Saturday cautioned against using SB 91 as a scapegoat for a number of overlapping issues facing Anchorage and the state. One of them was Sean Dabney, who spent most of his adult life behind bars from a drug offense in his early 20s. Dabney says he sees blame being heaped on SB 91 as people look for explanations to complex, overlapping social issues.
It seems like right now it's just a witch hunt. SB 91 is the witch, and we're trying to get rid of it. But you can't just throw people away. And if you repeal SB 91, then to me, you're still lock them up, throw away the key.
Both resolutions on SB 91, the reform and the repeal options, will go to a vote before the full assembly during its Tuesday night meeting. The second floor of the Atwood Center at Alaska Pacific University was packed shoulder to shoulder today with dozens of Alaskans who gathered to celebrate the first official Indigenous Peoples Day in Alaska. The celebration at APU featured an opening blessing, buffet lunch and music and dance performances. BYOD, or Bring Your Own Drum, was a commonly quoted term at the event. In June of this year, Governor Bill Walker signed legislation recognizing Indigenous Peoples Day in Alaska, replacing Columbus Day. Alaska is the second state in the nation to make the official change. Elizabeth Rexford was a first Alaskans Institute fellow who worked with Representative Dean Westlake of Kotzebue. Westlake was one of the representatives who sponsored the legislation that created Indigenous Peoples Day within the state. Rexford mirrored the excitement of the day's gathering.
You know, it warms my heart to see everyone coming together and to be proud of our histories, our cultures, the diversity here in the state, and to today a lot of people are wearing their Atik luks, their kusbuks, their regalia, their their native bling earrings and barrettes and things like that. And I think that it's every year it's only going to grow from here on out.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks is also holding events to honor Indigenous Peoples Day today, highlighting Alaska Native cultures. UAF Vice Chancellor of Rural Community and Native Education, Yvonne Peter, says it arose out of support from across the university community.
We had a groundswell of student government organizations, formal resolutions from UAS and UAF student bodies, and then later the Staff Alliance and the Faculty Alliance submitting letters to President Johnson encouraging the recognition within the UA system. And President Johnson did sign a memo saying we're going to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day in alignment with what came out of the state government.
Peter says the evening program features Native dancing and singing, comments from community leaders, and UAF professors speaking in three Alaska Native languages.
Gwich'in, Yupik, and Inupiaq.
He says the university is a natural venue for the Indigenous Peoples Day celebration because it brings together peoples from across the state.
We serve a really broad swath of the state. And we have, I think, something like 13 indigenous languages that are a part of that geographic spread. And so not only is UAF an institution here in Fairbanks, or Tanun is what we call it in Gwich'in, but we also have these different campuses spread out throughout the state.
Peter says UAF has been investing in Alaska Native arts and education over the last several decades, and today offers everything from a certificate in tribal management to a PhD in Indigenous studies. Indigenous Peoples Day will be celebrated each year in Alaska on the second Monday of October. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the King of Norway gives a medal to a woman in Petersburg.
His Majesty, he really honors those who are advocating the relationship between, in this case, our two countries.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI Business, with complete GCI data solutions for Alaska's most important organizations. GCI is your partner in possibilities. And by Raven Alaska, committed to customer safety and satisfaction, reminding Alaska that now is a great time to fly. Learn more at flyravn.com.
A 42-year-old Ketchikan man was arrested and charged Friday with first-degree murder and tampering with evidence for allegedly killing 55-year-old Richard Branda on Thursday evening. Joshua Kenneth Bliss had his first court appearance over the weekend. Bail was set at $250,000, and a public defense attorney was appointed to represent him. Some details into the alleged crime were available in a complaint filed in court by Ketchikan Police Sergeant Mike Purcell. He writes, police received a call at about 11:30 Friday morning. Purcell writes, police found Richard Branda dead with a large stab wound on the right side of his neck. The complaint states that Bliss called the police station later on Friday to report his involvement. Police say Bliss told officers he had stabbed Branda in the neck on Thursday evening during an argument. Bliss also allegedly told police that he threw the knife he had used into the ocean the next day. Bliss's next scheduled court appearance is 9 a.m. Friday in Ketchikan District Court. Governor Bill Walker announced Friday that he appointed Leslie Rydell to be Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Rydell says her focus will be on the bottom line.
Our priorities are to create as many efficiencies as we can for the state. We've been working really hard to provide service to the public and to our internal agencies to save money and to reduce costs and do as much as we can to help with the state.
The Department of Administration serves other state agencies, including overseeing labor relations. It also provides indigent defense and children's legal advocacy. Rydell has served as acting commissioner for the past month after serving as deputy commissioner for more than 2 years. The department will negotiate contracts with 7 labor bargaining units in the coming year. She says she didn't say whether the administration will pursue pay freezes supported by some lawmakers.
We're just getting started on most of them this fall, so of course pay will be a topic of the negotiations. I don't know for sure what all will come up at this point. I can't negotiate here on the radio with you, but everything's on the table in the beginning, of course.
Rydell is a Juneau resident. She has worked for Mark Bagich when he was a U.S. Senator and Anchorage mayor, the legislature, and Governor Tony Knowles. And she was an 8th grade social studies and English teacher in Eagle River. Indian Point, a former Tlingit village site on Auk Bay, may be ceded to a nonprofit dedicated to Akwakan heritage. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, the land was controversially acquired by the federal government before ending up in municipal hands in the 1960s.
At the southernmost point of Auk Cape, a rocky outcropping offers sweeping views of Indian Cove and Indian Island. Auk Cape is commonly known as Indian Point. These names give away this area's history.
This is a south-facing waterfront lot with beautiful views of Auk Bay, which is the exact reason that the Native people selected it for their village site so many centuries ago.
Greg Cheney is a lands manager for the city and borough of Juneau. The Cape Southern Tip has been city-owned since the 1960s. It picked up a third track in a three-way swap in the 1990s and now owns most of the Cape.
It's very much like finding a wallet that somebody has. You pick it up on the street and you realize, oh, this belongs to somebody. And so then, you know, I think most people would agree the proper thing to do is to return it to the rightful owners.
A former Juneau assemblyman wrote to the assembly last month recommending that the city give Indian Point to the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Randy Wanamaker penned that letter. The 73-year-old now lives in Seattle, but remembers spending time there as a boy with his grandfather, who was born on Auk Bay.
We used to put branches in the water for the herring eggs and dip nets in the water and get the herring out. You know, that was a practice that was going on for thousands of years, but it got wiped out by the commercial fisheries.
Gold Belt Heritage shouldn't be confused with its sister organization, Gold Belt Incorporated, a for-profit native corporation. The nonprofit's mission is cultural stewardship.
You know, they do a lot of things that honor and respect the culture and history of the original inhabitants.
The story of how Indian Point became government land is typical of what happened to many Native villages across Alaska. By the 1920s, much of the Native population around Auk Bay had moved to Juneau and Douglas to work in the mines, though they would periodically return to Auk Bay to hunt, fish, and gather food.
You know, they were practicing an environmental lifestyle that was in balance with nature. But the Forest Service in Southeast Alaska always said it was not used and had been abandoned, and that's how that would be their justification they used when they acquired it for the federal government.
To this day, much of the land around Auk Bay remains federal, part of the Tongass National Forest.
The federal government did not consult with the Alaska Native people when they dispossessed them of their land. They just took it away.
As recently as 2002, the Forest Service's official history in Alaska asserts that Auk Bay villages were abandoned. Anthropologist Tom Thornton investigated the cultural value of Indian Point on behalf of the federal government in the 1990s. He said it wasn't so simple.
There was sort of a larger campaign to move Native people off of the Tongass Forest land and, you know, burning cabins and things like that. And the Forest Service always denied that until they stopped denying it and then apologized for it.
The Forest Service officially admitted in 2008 that it had removed fish camps and smokehouses, vital for the subsistence lifestyle, in the early 20th century. Tongass National Forest spokesman Paul Robbins Jr. said in a statement that the Forest Service acknowledges that the destruction wasn't limited to fish camps.
As we continue our dialogue with the Occoquan and the various other tribes in this region, the Forest Service is going to remain open to all new information as historians continue to delve into the storied past of Southeast Alaska.
But back to Indian Point. Greg Cheney, the city lands manager, notes this is prime waterfront property, some of the most valuable holdings in the city's portfolio.
So that's why we have to be very careful about transferring it to an organization that's going to look out for the cultural interests of the Occoquan and not, just look at it as a multi-million dollar asset.
But he says personally, giving it to Gold Belt Heritage feels like the right thing to do.
In our current generation, we have the opportunity to right a wrong that was done generations ago. This was the old village site. This was a sacred site, and we could return it to the Auk people in our time.
Indian Point was almost cut up in the 1960s for a housing subdivision. Opposition by the Alaska Native Brotherhood and others put a stop to that. A half century later, the possible fate of Indian Point again lies with the Juneau Assembly. The Lands Committee is slated to consider the transfer later this month. In Auk Bay, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
A Petersburg resident has been recognized by the King of Norway for her dedication to promoting relations between Norway and the U.S. The ambassador of Norway to the United States was in Petersburg last month to hand out the Medal of St. Olaf. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
A handful of Petersburg residents are gathered at Glo Wallen's beachfront home to have a cookout. Wallen is the current president of the local Sons of Norway Lodge, and she's also the town's harbor master. At this point, she has no idea she's getting an award. Only a few choice people know. As far as Wallen's concerned, she's just hosting important visitors. The last time the Norwegian ambassador visited Petersburg for the Little Norway Festival in 2015, Wallen also hosted a barbecue at her place.
We're hosting the ambassador of Norway to the United States of America here and his assistant and our Norwegian consul that's located up in Anchorage. So we're having a little Alaskan party. We also have the Lieutenant Governor of Alaska's here as well.
Southeast Alaska's Senator Bert Stedman is also here. People are socializing in the backyard, while local black cod, salmon, and shrimp are grilled over a fire. Soon, people are called around the deck, because Ambassador Kåre Aas wants to publicly thank Wallen for the hospitality, and...
His Majesty, King Harald V, he has told me to come here. When His Majesty wants to honor a person or persons, he gives them the St. Olav's Medal.
The medal is round and silver and hangs from a red, blue, and white ribbon. Wallen also receives a diploma. Aas says the medal is given to Norwegians or foreigners who have been working hard to strengthen the relationship between Norway and another country, in this case, the U.S. He says he nominated Wallen for the medal.
Since you were born and your mother is here, you grew up in a fishing family and your father... He told you a lot about values, Norwegian values, and your mother, she told you about how to interact with other persons, how to sew, how to cook.
After the award is given, Wallen receives hugs from friends and family and poses for photos. Later, Aas tells me more about the meaning of the King's Medal. He says they are seldom given out, maybe one a year to Americans.
It's really a recognition about what Glo has been doing. In working and promoting and maintaining Norwegian values and in Alaska, but also really emphasizing what many Norwegian Americans think about the relationship to Norway historically, politically, but also culturally. And His Majesty, he really honors those who are advocating the relationship between, in this case, our two countries.
Aas says that based on this recognition, he believes that when Wallen visits Norway, which she hopes to do, she will be able to meet the King of Norway. Wallen herself didn't give any speech after receiving the award, but besides wearing a new medal on her chest, she also had a beaming smile on her face. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
This summer, a popular water source in Haines tested positive for E. coli. The Mud Spring Bay Spring is not regulated by the borough and is not regularly tested, but it's where a lot of people get their drinking water. And as KHNS's Abby Collins reports, some residents are not planning to stop.
Rayanne Glasso is filling up several buckets of water and loading them into the back of her car. She says she's been drinking this water for a long time.
And sometimes for cleaning, you know, because I have a dry cabin, so it's all this water. And I've been using it for over 20 years, and my plants do really well, my house plants. I like it. And tastes great.
But she says it is concerning that it's not tested. And that concerned me, too. I sent samples to the Juneau-based water testing company Admiralty Environmental. The lab results show no significant levels of arsenic, nitrates, or nitrites. But they did find E. coli. The test doesn't show what strain of the bacteria is present. Cindy Christian is a drinking water specialist at the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. She says E. coli is not always bad for you. There are strains that are harmful, but some that are benign.
but they're all associated with fecal matter that comes from mammals and some other organisms. Birds and things can carry E. coli also. So in drinking water, they are not supposed to be there at all.
Christian says E. coli is an indicator bacteria. It could mean other nasty stuff is in the water too, like salmonella or giardia. With waterborne diseases like these, Christian says the symptoms are usually gastrointestinal. You might have diarrhea, abdominal cramping, or lose your appetite. Haines resident Randy McDonald says he's the one that put in the pipes and built up the rock around them. McDonald didn't want to be recorded for this story. He said he installed the pipes in the mid-1980s. McDonald says people were already getting water at the spot, but he made improvements to increase the water flow. Someone did take measures to keep animals away from the water, but the fencing has fallen over since then. Christian with the DEC says Haines isn't alone here. She's come across similar unregulated drinking water sources around the state. She says in terms of monitoring water quality, it doesn't really matter whether it's a spring or runoff.
Springs are usually treated as surface water also, so even if it were a natural spring, it would still may not be suitable for drinking.
She says the safest bet for people who want to keep drinking the water is to boil it. But many residents who have depended on the water source for years aren't scared away by the E. coli. Crystal Norberg lives out Mud Bay and is even more reliant on the water because she has a dry cabin.
I've drank it for 10 years. I've never gotten sick, nor have I ever known anyone to have gotten sick.
After we reported on the presence of E. coli in the water, the Haines Borough started looking into testing it. At a recent meeting, the assembly voted unanimously to conduct a test. But Christian says no matter how many tests you do, one thing isn't likely to change. She says because the so-called spring is untreated surface water exposed to elements and wildlife, it's always likely to have bacteria like E. coli. Reporting in Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, and Samantha Davenport in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Abby Collins in Haines. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel October 12th and 13th at the Yupit Pichigyagait Cultural Center from 9 to 5. To discuss proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and other issues related to subsistence, the public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.